This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. This is your host, Basma Farhat, here where we believe that when the people speak, they make a difference. Today, the people are speaking with Ray Dawn Chong, actress and daughter of Tommy Chong of Cheech and Chong fame. Welcome to the People Speak Radio Show, Ray. It's a pleasure having you with us.
Thank you, Basma. I'm pleased to be here.
I hope the sound is a little bit better now.
It's much, 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 much better. Thank you.
Good. I'm really glad. It's a little bit distorted until we get into the queue. It's just a pleasure having you. You sound like a delightful person, and I've always enjoyed you. One of your most famous roles was Squeak in the movie The Color Purple, Ray.
Yeah,
she was adorable.
That's interesting because we're getting a lot of attention because of the fantastic, magnificent Broadway musical, which is playing right now, and I want everybody to rush out and see the best musical ever. And even though I was in the movie and I thought the movie was good, I really, 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 really think the play and musical just is a revelation. It's like going to church. But the best part of church, where you're transformed by fantastic music, amazing songwriting, superb dancing, just outstanding acting, and the woman who plays the lead, she's from American Idol. God, I'm forgetting her name for some reason. Fantasia. She is a revelation. So please don't be frightened of having wall-to-wall black people around you. Please, people, go out there and see The Color Purple because it deserves it. It deserves the audience.
Well, listen, I think the Color Purple,
The Color Purple, the musical. Sorry, say that again.
I said The Color Purple speaks for itself. I have a hard time imagining that the play is better than the movie, because it's really one of my all-time favorite movies.
The play is so much better than the movie. I'm in the movie, but I can't even begin. The first note of this musical, you begin to just, you cry, you laugh, and I know all the story points. I've read the book 4 times, I did the movie, and still I was surprised, and still I was delighted. I can't even tell, I'm raving about something I have nothing to do with, but I just tell you, please, people, go see this musical.
Well, you know, Ray, one of the things that I found the most absolutely amazing about the movie or even the play, because the plot itself is that, and Squeak, this incredible woman that was that came in the end, she turned out to be a goddess. And one of the things that I found so unbelievably incredible about the movie The Color Purple or the play is that even with all of the things that were going around with spousal abuse, the human emotions such as jealousy and the power men held over these women, and yet the women throughout the entire movie and the play stood together as sisters. And I just thought that was amazing.
You know, I think that it is the capacity of the soul of the human condition. I think the heart it's the capacity of the human heart. And I would hate to sort of say that it's a cultural thing only found in the African American community or only found in the African American female community. But I think wherever there is deep, deep, deep hardship and abuse and pain through many generations, like we've had in the African American community, that I think that it does make for some spectacular character, and this was a wonderful way to articulate and communicate that. And I think Squeak in the book particularly, and then of course in this musical, she is a big person in that tiny little body. She's such a big person, and she does in the end not only love Harpo, but she loves what he loves, and that involves Sophia. So that is great. Yeah. hardship.
Well,
brings
exactly,
out a lot of good
and
things.
You pulled it off brilliantly. I have to tell you, congratulations. Let me ask you, Ray, how do you feel about women in today's society?
Well, I have to say, you know, I think it's a big, I think we still have a big row to hoe, and I was raised, my father, as funny as he is, he had some pretty bad social habits, I think, and, you know, like a lot of men of a certain age, they think it's funny, ha, 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 but some of the things is whether they're sexist, racist, or whatever, you know, they're socially, like, you know, the N-word or whatever said in a loving way or whatever, or the H-word for women said in a loving way, and even, you know, in my family, I call them unconscious bigots or unconscious sexists because they don't really realize that they are saying things that are damaging. And particularly in our society now, it's still, I think, considered okay to treat women so poorly. And we have it much better than anybody else in the rest of the world, so I'm really sort of feeling, you know, a little bit gutted to have to even complain about the way we have it here in the West. But I do still think we have a long way to go before we, you know, first of all, we still need equal pay, we still need equal respect, and it kind of shocks me because, you know, this is 2007, you know, this isn't 1901, so I'm amazed how slow it is in terms of transformation in a social sense, in terms of our relationship
and absolutely,
healing.
Absolutely.
And it makes me sad because I'm a mother of a son, so I have a 25-year-old son, and I feel like
wow.
I've taught him lies. Yeah, I mean,
you
but I feel,
beautiful.
I feel like
I can't believe you have a 25-year-old son.
I had him when I was 21.
Absolutely adorable.
Thank you. But one of the things I did as a mother and as a single mother was that I made sure that he had a lot of relation with his father, that he was very, very close and a lot of time with his dad. So it was one of my intentions as a new mother to raise as balanced a person as possible so that his relationship with the female, me and all the women in his life, would be healthiest. And I think with our society being socioeconomically pressured, particularly with fatherless children being the norm, I find that it's difficult to raise balanced males. And so when it's only a single-parent home, particularly, you know, a mother-dominant home, I find it's harder to raise a healthy male emotionally, psychically, and maybe even spiritually. So,
I think even more so probably now than it ever at any other time. There was a time I think it was probably a little bit easier, but today there's a lot of just so much turmoil in our society as a general rule of thumb, especially in a war society. Now that we have entered that
yeah.
phase,
and it's tough
very
when you're
difficult.
You know, when the highest office in the country has the lowest amount of integrity. I mean, you know, if you think about it, our administration really archetypally it represents masculine, it represents father, and when you've
yes.
got a father basically abusing the world, you know, and a father who is abusive in terms of just the whole idea of America and the, you know, or the idea of our administration, and then the highest office, which is president, and you've got someone up there who is actually shirking his duty and has no qualms about telling lies and doing sort of super damaging things, it's no wonder that this country particularly, that it resonates down all the way through. So we're in for it. I think, you know, we have a long way to go to heal, and but we're starting. I mean, listen, bad times make for smart people and smarter adjustments. So,
well,
it's like that gypsy's curse.
That's an incredible insight. Yeah, and I had never thought of a relationship between a parental. Well, obviously, we see community and government as a parental womb. But I always thought of it in the feminine sense, but never thought about it as you had just suggested in the patriarchal sense, the sense of Bush being the father of our country, which is a frightening thought. I agree with you.
Well, and the thing that's also tough is that even the potential candidates, just in terms of the way we sell our potential future president, and I don't know, I mean, this time I'm sure that the majority of Americans are paying attention to all the pre-primary interviews, and I think a lot of people are really measuring and noticing that a lot of our politicians cannot answer a straight question, just a yes and no answer, and you know, and it's just, I think it's disheartening. There's a few candidates I think that are straight, and but you know, one feels so sorry for whoever gets the job next, because it's going to be just a pile of trouble.
I know. Talk about an inherited mess.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't help but notice, and I have to bring this up. I promised my husband I would bring this up because he's a great fan of yours. Your birthday and his are on exactly the same day. Different years. You're much younger than he is, but your birthday and his are on the same day, and you're a Pisces.
Oh, isn't
and
that
he
fun?
Was just thrilled about that.
That's so cute. Well, you know, February 28, people, we have an interesting tough. We're very strong, but we get into trouble. And I have a few friends where we get into a lot of trouble, but we have deep passion, and I think that that's a good thing. Does he have trouble? You know, does he have to watch what he eats? Is he terrible with money?
I mean, oh my God, we don't even go there with money. We just don't talk about it anymore.
I know, right?
Right, so yeah.
You know, I'm certain it's my birthday. I keep blaming it on that. I just sometimes think if I'd only respect it more and you know, hoard it better. But, yeah, no, it's a good birthday.
Well, that's right. As long as
he
keeps sending it on me, I'm okay with that.
Well, that's why he has you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And do you consider yourself to be a true Piscean? Pisceans are traditionally known for being extremely impressionable. As a young woman, as a young actress, are you an...
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm going to tell you something that I'm going to put it in my book that I will finish one day, but I just discovered as a woman, I didn't discover my ethnicity until I was 33, and I think that that says a lot about me, and I mean it in the sense of I never went to university. I was just straight out of school, early school, straight into film and working, so I didn't get to go yet to university and college, so I didn't know what political platform and what it meant to not only be a woman of color, really, but to be also a woman of African-American descent, and what it meant in terms politically. And so it wasn't until I was about 33 that I began to feel what it was and to really acknowledge and then also understand that, you know, sometimes we're asked to play it. Because I always, as a child, because it was so painful to be different and to be other, I just ignored it. Now, I didn't mean to disrespect it. I just ignored it. And I come from a place that was predominantly white, but then there were Native Americans or Native Canadians. I came from Canada, so, and then all my family were African Canadians. So I did see people of color around me, but my day-to-day world was sort of colorless. Even if it was behind my back, and there was racism, no doubt, in my life, I ignored it. And I often wonder if that was one of the reasons why I got some of the parts I did as a young actor, was because I didn't come in sort of fully loaded with an agenda. The flip side of that is when movies changed and people wanted to be more political and it was very Afrocentric, I suffered the consequence of it because I wasn't, you know, throwing the banner around. And it's fascinating, isn't it?
Well, you know, I do understand completely, well, at least as completely as I can coming from my position, where you're coming from, because growing up Palestinian American in this country, I came to this country as a naturalized immigrant at the age of 3 and a half, but we never looked the same. We were dark-skinned, we had curly hair, we were fully endowed, and by the prime old age of 9, so we were
right.
So different from Americans, and here we are wanting to be nothing but. And I understood what you said, where you put it out of your mind, you put it off to the side, you just didn't think about it, because and you lived in a colorless world. I lived in an American world in a Palestinian body, and that was and I understand that relationship.
And it's then as a, see, because I think The thing about being an actor or the thing about being an artist and somebody who communicates is that sometimes you are supposed to politicize what it is that you represent. Sometimes. I don't know that it's all the time, and certainly we would be very boring. And I think there are some people who do sort of maybe are guilty of that. But sometimes it is important to wear it. And so it's been interesting for me to find the balance, you know, and to not reject either side of it, to appreciate all of it, but just to sit here and say, this is interesting. I guess that's also the joy of aging, but that you get a little
bit
wiser.
Ray, let me ask you then, you bring out, and now I know you have a multi-ethnic ancestry, mm-hmm. But everything that you have been suggesting is that you lean towards your black ethnicity.
Because I think it's the majority genetically in me anyway. It wins.
Okay.
It won. When you look at me, I'm black. I mean, it's not like I'm anything else. I mean, even if you know I do have other things going, you know, through me, but I'm sure if they were to take my DNA, it would be the largest aspect. You know, or it would be fascinating. I actually do want to do it because I have a very sort of fractured family, and all the stories, I just don't know who you can trust, who's telling the truth, you know, of what's what. I mean, I know that my dad's Chinese and Irish, Scotch-Irish, and my mother was, you know, African-Canadian and Cherokee, but the majority, she's very light-skinned with high cheekbones, my mom, so she looked Cherokee, but she was African. So I don't know... you know, what the percentage is. And then it would be curious to see what her mix is as well. But I don't see my biological mother. I was actually put into an orphanage when I was when I was really young. And I was adopted
really?
By my father's mother, yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. How did that
I was the
come
I
about?
Was the beige sheep of the family.
That's wonderful.
Mm. That's why I give my dad a hard time. I'm tough on my
Can
father.
I ask you, it must have been a fascinating childhood, if to say the very least, it must have been fascinating growing up Tommy Chong's daughter.
Yeah, well, the good news was he didn't really raise me and my sister, because my stepmother, who raised us, she and my dad separated when I was 7. So we weren't, my sister was 5 and I was 7, we weren't really exposed to the insanity. We got him in doses, but we didn't have it on a day-to-day thing, which I think is one of the reasons why we turned out. I think it would be kind
of hard
to be.
And your relationship now?
Oh, we put up with him, and he's our dad, and we appreciate his appearances on the Stephen Colbert show recently. It was pretty funny, and he's just funny, you know. But it kind of comes and goes. Some days we like him better than others, and right now we're liking him. Right now he's all right. He did okay on MSNBC, and it's hard when you grew up, and we never felt like we ever got my sister and I could speak for my sister. We never felt like we got enough of him. On the other hand, now in hindsight, we're really glad we got what we got of him, because it was probably plenty. But he is so charming, and growing up, he was just the most delicious creature. My father, so beautiful and funny. So we always felt a little bit like we got the short end of the stick. But as adults now, we look back and go, no, it was probably perfect. And we adore him, you know, we adore him. But to call my dad a dad or a father, that might be stretching it a bit.
You have just an amazing relationship with the image of and who and what your father was, and that's brilliant. That is just amazing. Now, as far as him being deliciously charming, we found him to be so ingratiating on our show. He was on our show not too long ago, and we just had a wonderful time with him. And you're right, he's a charming man, and I just find it fascinating that you have so depicted this relationship between you and him. With such a sense of graciousness and love, it comes through. You project that.
Well, you know, it's really funny. I could tell you, if you caught me maybe 5 years ago or 10 years ago, it would have been maybe a little different story. It's just that I've noticed, and I don't know if you've noticed this, but if you when you really go after something or you feel really slighted by something, 9 times out of 10, if you articulate it in a super negative way, it really mostly doesn't shine well on you. You know what I mean? Even if you're correct, even if it's right, and even if you're right to feel what you feel, I've just noticed you have to sort of find peace with so-called difficult subjects in our lives because, I don't know, not to let people off the hook or to let, you know, to forget things, but I think it's essential to find a way to understand things and to find a way to understand potential, you know, heartbreak. I think it's important to just know that we're partly, you know, we're 50%, I think, responsible for everything, so at least. And I think it makes it for more of a peaceful existence. And I just care about how things reflect on me. And, you know, that's the truth. So it isn't so altruistic. I'm not being too generous.
Well, I'll tell you, Ray, you are just delightfully refreshing in just your entire demeanor. I'm not just saying this because you're Ray Dawn Chong. I'm saying this because it is so difficult in today's society to find people that are authentic. Authenticity is, I think, something that, especially in the Hollywood community, and you are truly an authentic woman. How, congratulations, bravo to you.
Oh, well, I thought you fooled. Thank you.
Let me ask you, a movie, The Constellation. Now, I've done some reading on this, and this sounds like a truly deep and powerful movie. You're playing the character Jetta alongside Billy Dee Williams and Gabriella Union. Tell us about Constellation.
My role, I play the young lover of the Billy Dee Williams character, and I have a child with him. He's separated from his wife, and he hooks up with me for a spell, and we have a child together. But the movie is about a particular family, and Billy's sister actually is the nucleus that we orbit around, which is the constellation reference. So it's about family and racism in the South, love, family, forgiveness. And I play one of the women that satellite around this particular woman, played by Gabrielle Union. And it was an interesting experience. I really fell in love with Alabama. I fell in love with Huntsville. I can't believe I'd ever say that because, you know, us Northerners have a sort of a dim view of the South. And I was edumacated, you know. It's very, very sophisticated.
Well, I tell you, I know exactly what you're talking about. My family moved to Kentucky 25 years ago, and boy, that was a culture shock for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. And yeah, there's some knuckleheads and some serious confusion, but I really appreciated it, and I appreciated being down there. I ended up doing something interesting. I have to tell you a story. Can I tell you a quick story?
Oh, please do.
I ended up being on Constellation, and, you know, I have a very small role in the movie, but more importantly, the director likes me so much as a person and as a part of the ensemble that he kept me there for, I'd say, 7 weeks longer than I needed to be, so I had a lot of free time. And at the time, I had just written this Cheech and Chong reunion script. I was the one that got them back together for 5 minutes to see if they could maybe do a new movie. And so in order to do that, I wrote a screenplay for them. And I thought it was quite delightful, actually. And my dad read it and said he thought it was perfect. And then Cheech read it and said he liked it. And, well, I submitted it to the big read for the weekend, and every studio wanted to look at it and stuff like that. And then midway through the weekend, I think Cheech got cold feet and got worried, and probably rightfully so. And he pulled out of my script, and then it died, as it can happen in Hollywood. And it was rough. So everyone basically said, well, we're interested in Cheech and Chong, but we're not interested in the script, and so we're going to carry on. And my intention for my script was to get them together anyway, so I had succeeded. So I took my little script and I filed it away. Well, while I was down in Alabama doing the movie, I had free time, and my friend Larry Charles, who directed Borat, he had actually read my movie Blend, and he said, why don't you rewrite it for somebody younger? Just keep the premise and everything, just change it from those two old guys and do it younger. So I did. I retooled it. And then I thought it was pretty clever, and still it was like a resounding thud. Nobody was interested, so I put it away. Well, this spring, my sister calls me from Toronto, and she says, "Sister," she says, "there's this screenwriting contest. Why don't you submit something?" So I submitted one of my favorite scripts that I've recently, this is what I've been doing the last 16 years is writing, and I submitted a script that I had written that I was very proud of, another script, by the way, and they rejected it. They said, "Ms. Chong, we like two-thirds of the film, but we don't like the first third, but you overpaid for submissions. Do you have another film?" So on your computer, and on my computer I had Blunt, so I sent that in thinking whatever. Well, it just won the whole thing, and isn't that fun?
How wonderful.
And it's
how
so weird
amazing.
Because I just won this huge contest, and it was a very large field of screenplays, and it just won, and part of the winning of it is that they take the finalist scripts, were three of us, and they had me fly into Toronto, and they have actors read the first act of this thing in front of a live audience, and then the audience votes for the piece. Well, I just, on this June, this just a week or so ago, I sat in this audience and watched the first 24 pages of this movie being read with actors, and we won by a landslide, because it's like a final, and it's really funny, and now I've got, like, you can't imagine my schedule right now, all these but companies and little studios wanting to meet with me for this movie that everybody basically passed on. And without the old geezers. Isn't that fun?
Well, you must be thrilled. Congratulations.
I'm in awe of the whole process because it feels a little bit magical, and I'm delighted to be getting such attention for this cute comedy because don't we have to laugh?
Well, you know, I would imagine that that's kind of how Hollywood works or the industry works. It's just when it happens, it just happens. And it's amazing, I think.
Well,
I think that's probably the most stunning part of it, isn't it?
Well, you know, I don't know. I'm still, you know, I'm just delighted. I think it's the sweetest, most... you know, it's just been a natural thing. The meetings have gone very well. The people that are interested in financing the film are delightful. I have met amazing people. I feel very confident. I've directed a couple things now, so I feel very confident. But they want me to direct it, which I think is really delicious. And I'm excited to watch young guys do basically, you know, they're not like those guys, those two characters, but they're similar. They have the essence of them. Like they're from, it's like pedigree. And then to know that I maybe have a little bit of that talent in terms of comedy in my blood, like, thanks, Dad. It's like I sort of, you know, I ran into Cheech just a couple days ago, and I said, thank you so much for turning down my script because it's being done the way it was supposed to be, unbeknownst to all of us. And he sort of went, what? And I explained that, you know, I just won this contest. And, yes, it is just so much sweeter. I'm just tickled pink. I'm a little gobsmacked, actually. I'm a little shocked. But, yeah, it's exciting.
And the play is called?
It's called Blunt. It's a movie, and it's called Blunt. Which is slang for joint.
Now, you heard it here, folks. We're going to be watching for this. We are going to be watching for this.
Yeah, in about 9 months.
You know, I think we suddenly feel like we're in on the ground floor of something. It's like a rising a movie right in front of our eyes. This is going to be so exciting for us.
Well, one thing I will say, just being in the theater, because I hadn't read it myself for a couple of years because it's been, you know, whenever you put something like that away, but I just sat there and I realized, you know, we just love to laugh. And when something's funny, it's like a gift from heaven. You know, it is the most delicious experience to sit there and just bust a gut. And I have to say, you know, it makes sense that it's one of the hardest forms to write is comedy. But when it works, it's just transcendent. So I'm very, very pleased. Very pleased. And thank you for letting me yak about it.
Congratulations. I am thrilled for you. Well, we're going to take a little break here, Ray, and we'll be back in just a moment. And for those of you that would like to call in, our studio number is 1-877-270-8714. Please call and give us your name. Try to limit your questions to a brief question for Ray Don Chong. And again, I'm just delighted to have you with us. You're just amazing. And you know, the word for you is delicious, wonderful. Right, we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
That.
Got questions? The library's got answers. and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hi, this is Randy Rhodes. You know, when Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held serious bipartisan investigations that did result in articles of impeachment. He resigned before he could be impeached, but strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war, lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court orders, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge, tortured, used illegal weapons, and targeted civilians. Ask your Congress member to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Join host Basima Farhat on The People Speak as she interviews guests from the realms of politics, activism, spirituality, science, and entertainment. That's Tuesdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on The People Speak, an audience interactive program where your voice counts.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the People Speak radio show. The people are speaking with Ray Dun Chong, actress
Hi.
Extraordinaire, and now writer of movies extraordinaire as well. We just talked to Ray Dun about her new movie that just won a number of contests called Blunt, and I hope everybody will be looking forward to seeing it as much as I am. I know I will. If you want to talk to Ray, you can call us at 877-270-8714. Once again, 877-270-8714. Ray, we do have a couple of questions here. Jim from Michigan. Jim, will you come to the mic and give us your question for Ray Dun Chong?
Okay, Ray Dun Chong, I find you a very interesting and sincere and an honest person. And I would like to, if you would be willing to share your political endorsement for president, who now you favor.
All right. My first instinct, well, I really like Barack Obama, and I think as a country, we would be smart to have a man of color, particularly with the issues over in the Middle East, and with a name like Barack Obama, it's hard to kind of accuse the United States of being racist and insensitive to the Middle East tribal issues. So I would just be so heartened to have President Obama be, in fact, the president. On the realistic side, I think it's going to be a hard election for him to get, and so if our country isn't ready to have a gorgeous, brilliant brown face as president yet, then I would love to see a ticket of I'd love to see maybe Vice President Obama, and as the president, maybe I would say John Edwards, if I had to choose. Although I did listen recently to Senator Biden, and I was very impressed with his take on the Iraqi war, I kind of almost wish I could splice a few of the candidates into one person and then still have Obama there. But that would be my answer. I love Hillary as a human being, and I think she's done some great work. And I actually think that she was way ahead of the curve with our medical mess that we have in this country. But there are things I don't like her stand on the Iraq war, and I find her vagueness a little bit. She's a little slick, and it bothers me. But that would be my answer.
Well, splicing a bunch of candidates together, that's an interesting one. I would like to do that, too.
I would like to take some of each of them and make one candidate.
Yes, make one that's worthy of our great United States. That's what
and
really
I do
need.
Really very much love Mr. Obama. I think that he's an extraordinary human being, and I do think that it would be an amazing salve, a great healing globally for this country just to have a brilliant charismatic, smart man who happens to just also be boasting, you know, tawny skin, but I don't know that that's going to happen. And so realistically, one has to look around and say, well, you know, as it goes along, we'll see how he does, but I don't know. But mind you, I didn't think Arnold Schwarzenegger was going to become governor, so what do I know?
Well, neither did anybody else at the time, and again, I have to agree with you, Ray, because I think that Obama would definitely be an elevation of our again, high standard that we at one time had in this country for the Oval Office. And I think that I know as myself as an American and many Americans that I have spoken to feel cheated by the Bush administration.
And the other thing is, too, I really like Gore, although friends of mine, I mean, Gore Obama ticket would just make my day. On the other hand, I have friends, I live in New Hampshire, and I have friends who are not convinced that Gore is, you know, so great. But that would be my dream ticket. And I know a lot of people are saying that, but I think that this country has to get off the pipe, and I think that, you know, if you think about it, our whole problem is our addiction to oil, and I know that it is a big problem, and I know that we would really miss the comfort of our current way that we live, but I just think that whenever you're addicted to anything, it really does threaten all integrity, and it's obvious. Look what's happened to our country. We're no better than a crack hoe, really.
No, very interesting analogy. And you heard it here, no better than a crack hoe. Our next question is from Mary from California. Mary, please come and give us your question for Ray Don Chong.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I'm really glad that Jim Starman asked that question, because I was going to ask that, but I changed my mind when you said something about calling your sister sister. My mother, her name is Ray, and so I've always kind of had a soft spot in my heart for you. Because of that. And I was curious if that was true. Do you call each other sisters or sis? Because my aunt calls my mother sis, and all of her children and all my cousins call her aunt sis. So it's kind of a dorky question, but it kind of reached out and grabbed my heart. And I agree with you in everything you said previously.
To answer your question, I do call her sister sis. Thank you. I do call her sis. I call her Sissy and Sis. And she's the love of my life, my sister.
It's wonderful that you have such a good relationship.
Well, we've earned it. We were raised very competitively, and it was terrible in a way, because we think of the many years we didn't get to be super close, and then we had a family tragedy happen, and it just opened our eyes, and it changed our relationship. I mean, we always loved each other, certainly, and we were always, you know, the two of us, but it was this one event happened, and it was the most incredible bridging. And now we get to just delight in each other, and there's so much trust and so much love, and it just makes me teary. But yes, to answer your question, Mary, I call her sis. Yes, I do.
Isn't that wonderful? You know, my little sister calls me Sissy. So she calls all three of her older sisters Sissy.
It's the best thing, you know. It's just we get to.
I got news for everybody. Sisters rock.
Yeah,
they really
it's the
do.
Gift. It's the gift.
Yes, we have our next caller, Mike from California. Mike, what's your question for Ray Don Chong?
I was wondering, what's your next project you have in line? Will you be, I know you recently did a film called Constellation, or it was recently released. What do you have next on the agenda as far as...
Well, it's funny you would ask. I happen to have a bunch of offers for some really amazing work, so I'm excited about it. I have a... there's two feature films that I probably am going to do. But I won't speak about them because I haven't closed the deals, but they're pretty interesting roles. I'm going to probably play a scientist in one, a geneticist, essentially, and in the other one I play a recovered recovered addict who is now basically helping kids that are on the street. So I sort of play a social worker, unofficial social worker. And that one's a pretty powerful piece as well, and I'm excited about them. And then I just got an offer yesterday for a television series in Canada. That's an eight-episode show, a small run, but it's a wonderful part, and I play a superintendent in that. I think we're going to be working on that one. They're pretty eager to get me, so I'm excited about that as far as the acting goes. Acting's great. It's like breathing, and I really enjoy inhabiting these souls. It's a wonderful opportunity, and I feel blessed. And I actually just got back this spring from DePauw University, in which I played a 80-year-old medicine woman, and that was also very challenging, but it was wonderful, wonderful. It was wonderful. So those are the acting jobs that are coming.
Interesting. 80 years old, I can't imagine you somehow. I have to admit, Ray, no matter what parts you ever do again, all I can see is when you went flying through the bar at Harpo's.
Isn't that funny? Well, yep, I can understand that, and that's all right. Actually, I did a movie a couple years ago, and I was like 50 pounds overweight. I was just like at a really crappy, depressed period in my life, and I was eating and drinking everything I could get my hands on, and I just looked like just pretty lardy. And I did this movie. I play a nun, and I did this movie, and I was so impressed with how awful I looked and how incredibly just a little bit fat. And instead of getting completely sad about it, I just sort of said, okay, we've now done that. Time to put the fork down
now we've
and
done
time
that.
To start working out. And so we have since lost more than half of that weight, and we're really happy to have our body back. But I will say that my drinking and eating tour was fun, but it's one of those things where I think people wouldn't recognize me in this movie. And I think that's kind of impressive. And I didn't do it on purpose, but there it goes. There you are.
Well, I'll tell you, I can imagine that you can do it in your way of work. One of the things as a writer myself I've always enjoyed is the different playing on words. And the way you have with words is just so delightful. I can imagine that you are going to be—you're a marvelous, marvelous writer. And please finish your book because you really need to do that. You know, as it turns out, Mike from California had dropped off and wanted to say thank you.
Thank you, Mike. I'm sorry if I was too long-winded.
No, was it you? I think somehow he just got disconnected, and I was just informed of that. Ray, you describe yourself as a civil activist, and some of the work that you've done, Habitat for Humanity, A Place Called Home, which I think sounds like an incredible project. Can you tell us about A Place Called Home and how you...
Well, I haven't been there in a couple of years. It's been a while. It's been like seven since I worked there. But A Place Called Home is downtown Los Angeles, right on the border of South Central and downtown. And it is an after-school program to help the kids in a highly compressed, pressurized neighborhood where there's no support at home, certainly after school. So between the hours of when school finishes and when their parents get home, it's probably the most dangerous time for inner-city kids. And Deborah has organized this retreat. Basically, kids come over and they learn new skills, they get their homework done, they're able to get tutoring, and they're able to do sports, dancing, acting, creative writing. I mean, it's a marvelous after-school program, and it's actually an accredited high school as well. So they asked, I know that Jasmine Guy started the arts program, and then I came in for over a year, and I think other actors do it. So this is just one of the programs that I was able to work with. And I was able to teach. My class I had, there were about 12 of them, and they were men and women, children. I taught them how to act. And I have to tell you something. It was super challenging because to act and to be a good actor, you have to be very, very open, I think, emotionally. But to be on the streets of you know, in essentially a ghetto, it will cost you your life. And so I was able to correct my own thinking and adjust the program and adjust some tricks and tools that I know to these children so that they wouldn't walk out of my studio and be in jeopardy. But it was interesting. I mean, isn't that interesting to think about?
It's fascinating, and I can imagine, especially in a place like Los Angeles, where these children have grown up with this this idealistic image of growing up to be rich and famous and well known and in the business. I would think that you would have a very, very idealistic children as well.
Well, that's true. I have friends who live in Malibu, and I think Malibu, just by nature, makes you know, super, super underwhelming children because it's very, very plush and cush, and it is much harder to get off a chintz couch than it is to get out of a ditch, I can tell you right now. So for all the kids that don't have a lot of good things in their life or who are struggling with pressure, whether it's lack of everything in a rough environment, you know, it's equal to, if not weirder, to be a super, super entitled and wealthy child who's ignored, probably abandoned as well, but lives in the lap of luxury and has really sort of, unfortunately, bottomed out values. I mean, I luckily had my son, and we lived a little bit in Malibu, but I was able to take him out of there as soon as I could, which was quite young, so he survived it and got through the gauntlet. But you know, people don't realize it is a bit of a gauntlet for children as well to become, you know, useful citizens of the world. And when you're in the lap of luxury and your values are so skewered, so it's a weird conundrum.
Well, I tell you, I think that you certainly have a handle and understand how it works. Your son is a very lucky young man. Let me ask you about the safe sex cautionary videos.
Oh yeah, that was
what
a long
exactly
time ago. The one for AIDS. Excuse me?
Oh, it was an AIDS. Okay, can you talk to us about you're not? Are you currently involved in anything that
that you guys
as far as
you know what?
Yeah.
I've been surviving for the last three. I hadn't worked in about 3.5 years, so I have just been surviving. And when you're in the survival mode, means trying to articulate or, you know, trying to pay bills and trying to just survive, it's harder for me time-wise to get out and do a lot of my community things that I naturally do, which is I usually check into a town wherever I am, and I do. The last thing I did was on Constellation when we checked into, I try to do this, when we checked into Huntsville, I immediately began working with the families of homicide victims, surviving family members of victims of homicide. And I was able to raise triple their budget, yearly budget, by doing not only services and benefits, but I was able to go down and do counseling. As I'm filming, I was able to do this. Boy, I had 7 weeks where I was essentially not working. So I immediately went into the community, and we did outreach programs, we did tutoring, we did counseling, I spoke a lot, but I was able to raise their yearly budget, but we did it 3 times for the Huntsville, and this again is a local, I shouldn't even be talking about this, it's just really so immodest, but it is for surviving family members of victims of homicide. And that was the last hardcore, you know, roll up my sleeves community service
that
I did.
Well, you certainly picked a really hardcore one, that's for sure.
Well, you know, it's
and
funny.
And I'll tell you, I don't think that you should be at all modest about this, because to me, this speaks of work that can be done by people that have an opportunity to do work, that have, look at what you've done for the budget to help victims of of horrendous crime. And
well, I'll tell you something. When you come to a town, particularly when you're on location, we end up having quite a bit of free time. And I know that Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie have made this very chic, but back in the day, starting out, you know, I would just tend to go into a town and find out what I could do, because you have the free time, you're getting paid, you're not really surviving. But then conversely, it's been a couple of years since I did that movie, almost 3. I haven't worked that much, so right now I've been just, you know, nose to the computer, you know, organizing my living situation. I have piles of debt to pay off. I mean, it's just been, I've been surviving, and it's just been this last probably 4 months that it's just shifted, and now this work has flooded in, and my film's probably going to get financed, and but then I'll go back to doing the work. But you know, I'm like everybody else. I'm such a normal person. I have, you know, bills to pay and things to worry about and debt to get out of, and so I haven't been able to have quite as much free time as I would. But when I do have free time, I try to pick the hardest thing to work on.
Well, again, your honesty is amazing. The down-to-earthness that you have is just so, I think, different than anybody probably ever anticipated coming from where you've come from. And I think it's wonderful. You know, we have an audience member that is just hollering and yelling for me to ask you a question. And her question, this is from Shell, her question is, what do you think about Paris Hilton?
I have watched her. I've actually been in a room, and I've actually been on the street. I've been in a room with her, and I've been on the street and seen all of the stuff. And I have a deep, deep, deep sense of almost, my tummy hurts when I think about her, because it is so intoxicating when you're the it girl. It is supremely intoxicating, and you just lose your ballast. You lose your sense of balance. And when I look at her and, you know, and her confusion, and I know that she's been on tape saying the N-word and kind of saying it in a not-so-great way, and, you know, can I just say one thing? She doesn't come from the smartest stock. I don't think her mom or dad are very bright. And I think that she might not be that smart. I don't know that she's ever, you know, I don't even know if she could read, really. You know, I mean, she's beautiful, and of that, in terms of that, you know, thing that we think is beautiful, that look. And, you know, I actually feel for her, because you do get in, you just get so intoxicated by all the fame and all the attention, you almost forget that you're, you know, like that it's for nothing. And I think that that poor rich girl, you know, has just lost her way, and I think it's a witch burning now. You know, I think it's just going to keep getting uglier. And I mean, I can't imagine that anybody's really that bad. And I just feel for her. I feel sorry for her, because I just think it's not pretty. You know, I think if she was super wise and if she had really good people around her, they would take her off the market, and, you know, maybe she should, you know, hone down and do something different, and maybe travel, or, you know, maybe start, you know, being a little deeper. I don't know. I just know that her mom and I don't get that her mom and dad are that smart. I mean, they just don't look that bright. And I just feel like she hasn't had a good shot in terms of, I don't know. It doesn't feel even, and it doesn't feel right. I just think she's so brilliant. So if money is your goal, then she's fantastic. And if fame is your goal, then she's a super success.
Well, from what I've heard about her parents, I mean, they've actually encouraged her and capitalized on her porn flick, so I guess that says a lot.
I just think that the dad is not very bright. If you look at him, he just looks like he might even be special needs. I mean, not to knock people with special needs, but he just doesn't look very smart. And I just think that she just hasn't really had that kind of good advice around her. And so, I don't know, it's kind of like making fun of Jim Baker or something. You know, they're kind of just so retarded that it's just like an easy pot shot. And I mean, I don't think she's, I think, you know, I don't know. I think, you know, we always sort of put people up on a pedestal. I mean, look at early Madonna days, you know. I mean, Madonna has sort of, you know, chiseled and carved herself into something, you know, sort of interesting. And, you know, and God knows she's an amazing record producer, but I just think, you know, we're so quick to take these people, build them up, and then burn them. And it's kind of, I think it's kind of misogynist, you know. And
As you say that, I picture that Madonna could probably be tough enough to take this, coming from the background that she did.
I'm just talking about early days Madonna, not the Madonna now. Not the Madonna.
Yeah,
I'm just talking about early days Madonna.
I don't see Paris as being able to withstand or sustain an onslaught of against her. I don't think she has the fortitude to hold up to that.
No, and you know what? The truth is that she needs to sit down and maybe, you know, she needs somebody really smart to say, listen, all of it's going to go south, and no matter how much money they're going to give you for this, that, and the other, now you're a freak. So I think ideally she should disappear a bit and maybe just go back to school or get married or maybe, you know, not even do that. Just hide for a while. I mean, if she's smart, she should just stop. She should just stop and just maybe go get smarter.
We've got a few more minutes, and there are a couple more questions that
I feel sorry for her. That's what I feel.
Yeah, I think I feel sorry for her too. I really do, because poor little rich girl is definitely evident in this one. I think.
And I think she's stupid. I don't think
skills.
They're very smart. She can't be that smart.
Right.
I think she's actually not very bright.
One of our audience members has a question for you. With all the social work you do and having grown up being a part of your father's legacy, how do you feel about the current hemp and marijuana laws?
Well, I think all the drug laws are skewered and screwed up. I think that it's as absurd. But we've filled up the courts. We have filled up the prisons. You know, I think Chris Rock said it best. You know, if drugs were grown and cultivated by people who weren't of color, they might be legal. I mean, in a way, you know, it's unfair, you know, but I'm not saying people should be doing drugs, and I'm not pushing that on people, but I do think our laws are really, really, really stringent, and I think that they're unnecessarily so. I think that when you take a country, whether it's Sweden or Amsterdam, where there's a lot of tolerance and certain, you know, you have to register if you're a junkie in Switzerland, you know, where there's an awareness, you know, there's taxation, there's programs. I mean, could you imagine all the tax revenue we're missing from the drug situation and all the awareness? And you know something? When people have access to something, they tend to not want to do it. Now, I'm not speaking of crystal meth. That's a whole other beast. I don't know anything about that drug. Wouldn't do it. It doesn't look like it's fun to me at all. But I'm just talking about, you know, marijuana particularly, or, you know, milder things like that. And I just think that our drug laws are antiquated and they're completely tied into the religious right, and it's painful. And I think it would empty out our prisons in a wonderful way. And I think that we'd have a lot more revenue available to do serious programs, and we might be able to reignite and remount our mental health programs, which we're desperate for. Thank you very much, Virginia Tech. I mean, this, we've got it ass backwards, and I'm not saying that people aren't right, that they're, you know, my father and I fight often, and I often scream at him and say, Dad, you know, you've left this pro-drug legacy, which I, by the way, disagree with, but I do think that there is a time and a place for almost every experience, and I think that our country would behoove us to revamp those drug laws and open up, and as Martin Sheen says, have a drug court, so be it. But I think it would be great to rethink it and start to capitalize and take some of that revenue into our society and start to take care of business in the right way.
It's, especially since we're doing very little to actually stop the
war
on drugs.
Stop
our
it.
Our
exactly.
Wars suddenly seem to catalyze an increase in measure.
Well,
every time
you know,
we have a war
that?
On
it's
violence or a war on drugs or a war on Iraq, we keep capitalizing on that and growing in our girths there.
It doesn't work. It's not worked. It's been a failure, and it's always been a failure. And honest to goodness, if you think about it deeply, and most people who are anti-drug don't, but if you think about it deeply, what is the difference between prohibition? And, you know, think about the change just in terms of the just nationally, how much easier things were. And honestly, drug addicts and drugs are boring. And if there were people allowed to make adult choices, you'd find they would probably start to get smarter. But the minute we start, being parents and, you know, making it filled illegal, it just brings out all sorts of other horrible things that we don't need. Yeah, we've got big, big fish to fry, and I can tell you right now, the drug war is one we don't need.
Well, bravo, and I'm afraid our show has come to an end, Ray. You have just been a tremendous smash. Thank you. Good luck with your movie Blunt. Good luck with The Constellation.
Thank you. Good luck
with all of your endeavors and your writing. You are a breath of fresh air on our show. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you all for being with The People Speak.
You're welcome. And everybody, thank you for listening. Bye.
You heard it. Thank you, Ray. Bye-bye. Our guest tomorrow night is Hannah Sossman, who is the spokesperson for the Prometheus Radio Project. And we'll be looking forward to having you all here tomorrow. Thank you very much, and good evening, everybody. This is the People Speak Radio, signing off.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the big wall, by the relief of the fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering, if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours, this land is mine, learn from care.